Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and I am very excited anytime I have an opportunity to say wonderful things and promote those that are going through our educational system here at Henry Ford College that have done some things sort of above and beyond or unique as a student. And boy, do we have a unique student to talk to today. So our first discussion is going to be with author and student Amanda Abraham talking about her new book called Dear Writing. So we look forward to hearing about what she's got to say and what she's written through Writers Republic in this book that is now available and out at the bookstores. So I would like to welcome Amanda to our show. Welcome to the Journal, Amanda. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you. It's very great to be talking to you as well.
Terrific. So I am guessing, based on the excerpts that I've read from your book called Dear Writing, that you do sort of have a love-hate relationship with some things in your experience and in your life and in your writing experience in particular. But how is it that a young student who is, you're a junior in high school at Allen Park High School, correct?
Yes.
And also a dual enrollment student here at Henry Ford College. So I think at that age, you know, there's this tendency to just be focused on the studies and the friends and the get-togethers and all of those sort of typical, standard, dare I say, normal things. And to actually be a published author at this phase of your life is pretty unique and I think pretty exciting. So where did it all begin? And you don't have to go back to the age of three, but go back as far as you want. Tell us a little bit about how this came to be.
So I did begin writing at the age of six. I've always enjoyed writing as a pastime, something to relieve stress and something that just helped me kind of understand the world around me, something that helped me to see things through a different light, through a different perspective. I've written multiple books before, actually. Some I finished, some I didn't, but Dear Writing was the first that I actually published. I started and finished it at the age of 16. I also published it at 16. So I've been writing over 10 years now. I do my best to fit it in with the studies. It helps me to de-stress from school type things and other aspects of life that could be difficult or stressful. So it's a very nice pastime for me.
Wonderful. I can hear people in the audience saying, oh my gosh, the process of writing would actually make me stressed out versus doing the exact opposite. But there is a wonderful, you know, contingency, I think, of young people, especially in this day and age, that find things like journaling or, you know, creating things in an artistic way to be quite a stress reliever of anxiety and so on, because there's a lot going on in the world today, as we know. So I'm excited that you have kind of taken that approach to your experience with writing. And you said you've written multiple books, some finished, some not. What made this one different? Why did Dear Writing, you know, cross the finish line?
Dear Writing had a little bit of a different plot than a lot of my other books. It is almost completely nonfiction, and it is a compilation of letters to writing, which is a little bit different from what I've done in the past. I've done some fiction. I've done some partial fiction. But Dear Writing in particular has the strongest base, I would say. And it's the most, you can kind of learn the most from it. Like it also has, the audience is the largest for Dear Writing compared to other books I've written. And it's just more, it just has a stronger base. There's more to it.
Yeah, maybe more relatable to a larger group of people.
Exactly.
I like that. Yeah. Well, why not go with that one, right? If it's if you're gonna publish one, make it the one that more people than not could potentially relate to. And I know I've interviewing authors in the past, and many of them say they write without worrying about the reader, without worrying about what that person, you know, that person that might pick up the book is going to feel or do. It was more for their own therapeutic experience. But In your situation here, being able to select from a compilation of letters that you created to the art of writing, I think that it feels like maybe there was an opportunity to sort of control that narrative a little bit, almost like editing what you think is going to work, what you think isn't going to work. How much goes into that on the front end of actually publishing a book? In yours, in this case, Your Dear Writing.
Quite a lot, actually. There was a lot of revisiting what I had previously written and a lot of changing, making things fit together a little bit. But overall, the book kind of goes in a circle. So it starts in one area and it starts with me having, questions about life, things that, writing letters to writing could help me figure out. And then it doesn't end in the same sort of way, but there are different experiences I go through that throughout the book, of course, that help it to come full circle. And you can see how where the start and the end are and how it the parts that make the ending kind of come around to where the beginning was. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And it makes me think actually about like the concept of characters. When we're dealing with nonfiction, we know that that means mm-hmm. that this is probably very personal. And you are probably the main character, if not, the dear writer, the writer or writing, I should say, that you're writing to. But, do you bring in other characters? Are there threads of other people that we will get to meet throughout, like people that have been important in your life? And how much of that might come to play in this?
So there are definitely other characters. It's written in the first person point of view. So although I'm the main character, I'm not the main subject. Writing's definitely the main subject. I've brought in some coaches, teachers, pastors, and my parents. Those are the main, other characters. And they definitely help with advancing the plot and help to, although I'm writing to answer questions, they're also there to guide me in certain directions, such as life. They've definitely done that throughout my life. So, of course, they deserve to be in the book for that.
Nice. We're talking with Amanda Abraham, and she is a published author out of Allen Park High School. She's a junior, and also we are lucky to have her here as a student, a dual enrollment student at Henry Ford College. And so we certainly like to showcase the experiences that our students have and have had and will in the future as well. And this is all about sort of finding your passion. And I think that's the inspirational message that it's what I gather from the portions that I've read. And you talk about other people sort of represented as characters. You have quite a robust life experience, and looking at what I would call just a snippet of your bio, you're very involved in a lot of things, athletics with trampolining. I've never met an official trampoliner, so I want to hear a little bit about that. I don't even know if that's the right term, but doing some coaching as well, going to school, singing also, and just, probably being a daughter and a friend and all those other things that happen at this age of one's life. So, tell us a little bit about your experience up to this point and what have you learned or sort of taken differently through the experience of publishing a book?
Okay. So, yes, I'm a dual enrolled high school student and a competitive trampolinist, a vocalist and a coach. All of those things I actually brought into the book. Those are all different aspects that I touch on, some more than others. Publishing a book has just pretty much fit perfectly into my lifestyle. I've, as we discussed earlier, I've been writing for a really long time. So publishing the book was kind of like the icing on the cake to my already enjoyable life.
And let me correct myself, trampolinist, not trampoliner. I had no
yes.
idea. So I've learned something with that. So thank you for that. How does one become a competitive trampolinist? And does that mean you can do all the flips and twists and all that kind of fun stuff?
I do a lot of flips and twists, yes. There's not actually a lot of competitive trampoline in Michigan right now. The team I train with is from Ohio. It is a 3-hour drive from where I live to the gym. So we go out there 2 to 3 times a week, and we have to fit that into our schedules, which we do willingly, but it's definitely, it keeps us busy.
Yeah. And that 2-3 hour drive a couple times a week maybe gives you some time to process, write, and maybe you're writing physically, literally while you're in the vehicle, whether, you know, of course not driving, but that opportunity to sort of be forced to have some downtime just to think about things seems like it would make sense to support your other interest, which is writing. Yes?
Yes. Definitely.
Good. Good. We talk about the art of finding one's passion. And at the age of, you know, a high school junior, are you 17 yet? You're still 16?
I turned 17 this month. So
turned
close.
Right. Happy birthday. So when we talk about someone finding their passion at this age, oftentimes it's a passion that's sort of a fly by night, like, oh, this is what I'm into today, but in a month it's going to be different. And then another month it's going to be different. You've established that you've been writing for 10 years, which seems to me that if you didn't like it, you wouldn't have been doing it this long. What other interests related to the art of sort of crafting a story or telling, you know, a narrative related to writing would you like to see yourself getting into, or the next one, or beyond that? Or would you like to totally change gears and now that you've conquered this at least once, maybe move over to something else?
I definitely would like to continue writing, not as a career, but something on the side, kind of like what I do now. I could also see myself working with different types of writing. Like, I do want to publish a fiction book at some point. I want to continue doing memoirs. Those are definitely fun. That's the genre of my book now. I definitely want to continue doing those, but definitely continuing writing and this type of passion. I don't think it's something that's going to go away for a long time.
All right. What was the experience like in doing the actual publishing? Because I know that we have very creative people that listen to our radio station. It's a creative radio station that maybe have had aspirations. Maybe they're not quite your age, but they're like quite a bit older. And like, well, if she can do it, she's pretty young. And if she can do it, I'll bet that maybe I could too. So what was that process like? And you also indicated earlier in a sort of pre-discussion that your mom is your media advisor, media manager, helps to have that support, huh?
Yes, definitely. So the publishing process was quite a bit simpler and shorter than I expected. Of course, that differs depending on who you publish with. So I published with Writers Republic, which is a self-publishing company. So they're not going to go into the book and change a bunch of things that I wrote. The process took about a little bit longer than 4 weeks. So not a lot of time at all. I initially reached out to them. They took interest in the story, and we got it going right then. They created my covers for me. I have some internal images in there that they put in there for me, and they formatted it. It was a really great experience, and I didn't have to do a whole lot of cover formatting thinking, which was helpful.
Yeah, because publishing and writing are two very different things. Really two different specialties, and one doesn't need to necessarily feed into the other one, but having that relationship and a company that you trust certainly does make sense. I know the book is available, paper book, paperback, hardcover, traditional, but also you offer it in a digital format, since that seems to be a big thing these days, I'm assuming?
Yes, it is. There's a Kindle version available, an ebook, and a PDF version.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit, Amanda, about who you see your target audience or your best case audience that would benefit most from reading some of the letters that you've written to Dear Writing.
You know, I honestly think that there's a super wide audience for this book. There could be teenagers, people my age, younger people, but also I've heard a lot of feedback from older people like age 75 and older, who have also really enjoyed it. I feel like different ages can have different takeaways from the story. So there's not a particular target audience or target age group. I think everybody could relate somehow and be able to take something away.
Great. Next steps for you, aside from hopefully acing your classes here at Henry Ford College and also your high school classes, but what are you working on? What's the next big thing for you?
The next big thing for me is probably graduating high school and then moving on to full-time college, where I plan to major in pre-med. I want to be an anesthesiologist, and I do want to continue competitive trampolining for as long as my body will allow.
Wonderful. Well, we are grateful for your time today and for your passion and helping through your passion others to find theirs, because certainly the sooner we can figure out what sparks us, the more time we have right on this earth to be able to embrace it and enjoy and live our best selves. So so it's very exciting and inspirational. Amanda, the book is available through Writers Republic, and we certainly encourage people to see what sparks their passion and sort of take this as a nudge to say it's never too early and it's never too late, right?
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you to your mom as well for helping to coordinate the things that you're doing with getting the word out about your book. And also, I'm sure she's just a huge support for you as a network is important to have those to rely on. Because while it sounds like you had just a wonderful experience with this whole process, I'm sure there have been some bumps along the way. So we want to make sure that we're surrounded by people that we care about and that trust, we trust, and that trust us to help make good decisions. So sounds like
that
works pretty good, huh?
Yes, for sure.
Excellent. All the best to you. We hope to see you on campus sometime, and we wish you continued success with your writing. Thanks for your time.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay. All right. We've been talking with Amanda Abraham. The book is called Dear Writing, available through Writers Republic, and it's all about finding your passion. I love the opening title, at least in the promotional piece online. It says, Dear Writing, What Have You Done to Me? So if you want to hear some answers to that question and more, check it out. So we appreciate you listening, and stay with us. We do have much more to come right here on the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Stay with us.
I would feel like an outsider. I'm not talking the way these people would want their comedians to talk.
What does it mean when someone says you're not black enough?
There'd be assumptions about my level of hip-hop knowledge or the new album, and I would just have to, fake it.
I'm Hannah Baba.
And I'm Leela Day.
From Radiotopia and PRX, this is The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
The Stoop.
Stories from across the black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee United people.
When a black woman walks up in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
Hey, Leela.
Hey, Hannah.
So, Leela, have you ever felt like you were out of place with a group of black people where someone made you feel like you weren't black enough?
Yeah, I mean, that is the story of our lives, right? I feel like we've talked about these instances when we were children feeling that way, that uncomfortable. Where do I fit in? Where do I belong? And now as an adult, I feel like those instances seem to happen more and more on social media, or when we're in a like large group of people having a discussion about race or something. And you start to feel criticized for not calling people out or not being bold enough or not being loud enough. And people will call you out. Well, you should have said this, and you should have done this, sister, and you should have done this, and this is how I would have done it, right?
That sounds like they're saying you're not black enough.
Right. I mean, it does feel like that. That reaction feels like that. It feels the same way as a kid when you're feeling like, wait, can I not sit at that table?
You thought you left that behind.
I did. What about you? Have you been having those experiences where you maybe feel not black enough?
Yeah. I mean, there was this time when I took my daughter to the salon and we went to get our nails done. And, you know, I talked to her. I say, Sarah, that's her name, Sarah. And so Sarah this, Sarah that. And while we're sitting there, this lady was finished. She was walking out and she came over to us and she's an African-American lady. And she was like, oh, daughter's so pretty, she's so cute, what's her name? And I said, Sarah. It's Sarah, but because we're Arabic speakers, it's Sarah. And she said, Arabic? And she looked at me, and she looked at my daughter, and she was like, oh, I thought y'all were black. And she just marches out of the salon, just like, no goodbye, no have a good day, nothing.
Oh my goodness. How did that make you feel?
It felt lonely. It felt lonely.
You know, I feel like we need to stoop this out. This feeling that people can sometimes make you feel.
Mm-hmm.
That you're just not black enough.
Yep. Let's do it.
So this idea of not feeling black enough, one area where this comes up is the way we speak. So, Hannah, has anyone ever told you you sound white?
Well, yes. All throughout my childhood, I've been told, you know, I look black, but I sound white.
You definitely look black.
You look black. Do I look black?
You do.
So, but I sound white. That's what I've been told. What about you?
Yes. And I've got some things to say about this. Okay, so for me, growing up, there were plenty of jokes about the way I talk.
Listen to how you talk, like a white girl. Who do you think you is?
You sound white when you're on the phone.
But I couldn't help the way I sounded. It's like my default voice. You know, you have that default voice. And it's just how I speak. Not all the time, but I grew up in Las Vegas, and there were two types of black kids in school. And there were those who hung out with other black kids and those who bounced back between black and white friends. And I was in the second group. I imagine you were too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with all that switching back and forth, my voice switched too. Mm-hmm. And it still does, like when I'm on the phone with my sister.
Girl, you better ask somebody. I do not know what you are talking about.
And it's not something I'm always conscious of. Sometimes it just sort of happens.
Code switching.
Yep.
Yeah, he came in looking all crazy, acting all crazy, talking all crazy. I was like, you better back off.
Now, as an adult, I have fun with it. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, it wasn't always this way.
All up in my Kool-Aid, you don't even know the flavor.
Finding my voice was painful. And at school, being told I sound white meant one thing. I wouldn't be eating my corn dog and tater tots at the black kids' lunch table. But that was then, you know, got over it.
Right.
And nowadays in some schools, corn dogs are replaced with tofu lookalikes. So it got me wondering if the conversation among teens has changed too.
Because teenagers nowadays eat tofu.
That's true. They do eat tofu. At least in the Bay Area they do.
That's right.
So I went to a place where I thought I might find some black teens who'd been accused of sounding white.
Where's that?
The skate park.
The skate park, of course.
Black people have told me I talk white before. Like, I don't know, like, what it means to, like, talk white or talk black.
They be saying I talk white. I get pissed off. They only do it because my mom's white, you know, so I have to speak respectable. And they think since I'm black, I have to act ghetto and be stupid.
I guess talking white would be, like, I don't know. Like, I want to say, like, speaking proper, I guess. Like how most white people talk or most normal people talk, you know?
This conversation about voice got me interested in talking to someone whose job is basically his voice.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for checking us out today.
Joshua Johnson is a journalist. He's been on MSNBC and NPR. He's African-American, and he sounds pretty similar when he's on the air.
He says he's noticed President Trump's immigration policies playing out in his community.
And when he's talking to me in person. Is this your radio voice?
This is my voice.
This is your voice. So is your...
People ask me that a lot. They're like, do your radio voice. I'm like, have we not been talking for 15 minutes? This is it. You know, my goal on the radio is to sound like me. I don't want to
sound like the news anchor who is enunciating the headlines at you.
But Joshua says he's experienced surprise reactions when people realize he's black.
we did a show about race and diversity in Silicon Valley. And somewhere in the show I mentioned that I'm African American. I forget what the context was, but somewhere in the show I mentioned it. And I got an email from a listener who basically wrote, "I never would have guessed that you were black."
Joshua says he doesn't let these reactions about his race really bother him because, like me, he's heard it all. That patronizing tone.
Mm-hmm.
"You are so articulate. You speak so well." And Joshua thinks this ignorance can also be a lesson in disguise. Show us assumptions we often have about race.
So how did he respond to that? Did you ask him?
I did ask him. Did you respond to that?
I did. I told him it was a very good thing that you as a white person have to stop looking at me as a black person as other and presume that I sound like everybody on BET.
Then I asked Joshua if he'd ever been accused of sounding white when he was growing up, and he tells me that he not only heard the accusation, but he grew up with black adults insinuating that it was preferable to sound white was to sound high quality.
That's kind of what those kids were saying.
Exactly.
In my hometown of West Palm Beach, Florida, I remember the choir director, Ms. Richardson, said, "I want you to sound so good that if I put you on stage behind a curtain and had you sing to the audience, everyone would swear you were white."
To sound marketable or quote-unquote proper.
Proper. Mm-hmm. We've heard that.
Is the goal most parents and teachers set out for kids, right?
Right.
I mean, saying the word "ain't" in my house would warrant a side glare from mom that was just as bad as a spanking.
Ain't.
Ain't. I ain't doing it.
Mm-mm.
So Joshua says he was very aware of this as a child.
I always knew there was something blessed and something cursed about the way I spoke. I knew that it would open doors for me, and I knew that none of my friends was behind those doors.
But what is it about the fear of these doors closing because of the way we sound? There's actually a name for it. It's called linguistic profiling.
There is such thing.
Linguistic profiling. It was a term coined by Professor John Baugh, and he's a PhD at Stanford University.
Uh-huh.
He did this study where he selected 5 racially diverse cities in the Bay Area to ask about housing for rent. First, he called using an African-American accent.
"Yes, my name is Michael Davis. I was calling to see if you might have any houses for rent that might be available."
Then he called again, this time with a Latino accent.
"Hello, this is Juan Ramirez. I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper."
With these accents, Baugh was often told nothing was available. But when he switched to what he called a neutral accent, he was often invited to see the properties.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But not surprising.
Not surprising. And you know what? I was recently linguistically profiled.
How?
Okay, so I was working on this story, and it involved a support group for African Americans. And many of them had a criminal record.
I remember that story.
Yep. And at first they seemed really open to being interviewed, and then they just turned cold. And days turned into weeks of messages without any return phone call.
I remember you having a hard time with them getting back to you.
Yeah, it was really difficult because they were totally open in the beginning. And so then we finally met one of the coordinators. She looked at me and she started laughing. And she says, "I would have gotten back to you sooner if I would have known you were black."
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
So I was in, right? I was in, and although we both laughed together about her comment, inside I was feeling deflated.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like eating that corn dog alone at lunch again. But as for my voice, whether it works to my advantage or not, it's just the one I got.
Just the one you got, Leela.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful one.
Oh, thank you.
You know, there's someone else that's got a lot to say about voice.
And she's right here in our backyard.
Yeah.
Oakland, California, Tanaka Hodge.
This is Trina's world. She walks above it all. Ghetto brown gel slicks Cosmo's back in her hair easily. She walks quickly. No time to talk. Shoots insults over her shoulder. Your mama. She's living for her lover's memory and he's not even dead yet. This is the sound. Pickles and red Kool-Aid sticking to her lips like blue now-laters, spiced apple cider, sunflower seeds, chitlins, and abject poverty. She's 14. Womanly. Big bosoms, bigger bottoms. Everybody wants to hold her thigh, hold her breast, hold her back. No one wants to hold her hand.
That is powerful.
That's Chinaka Hodge, Oakland poet, educator, playwright, and screenwriter.
And she did a TED Talk.
And that poem we just heard, Chinaka wrote that based on what she can see out of her window in West Oakland.
So that's where we went, to talk about voice.
How we sound and why it matters.
So let's go to West Oakland and hang out on her stoop.
The stoop is very much our kitchen and our living room and our sink, and it's been lots of things over the years. My dad comes out here and plays drums from time to time. We got a lot of stairs, a lot of stoops, and a lot of conversations here, but welcome.
So has anyone ever told you that you sound white?
Absolutely. Absolutely. On many occasions. I went to two small, independent black schools, so I had a different education than most straight out the gates. And so I left those schools and went to Cole Middle School in West Oakland, and that was the first time anyone had told me I'd sound white. But I'd never gone to school with any white folks. I went to a black gymnastic center, and I rode horses with the black cowboys, and I did black tennis camp. So in many ways I was bougie, but I'd never heard that I sounded white, because I'd never been around white folks. I sounded like every black person I'd ever been around. But when I got to Cole, there was definitely a different lexicon, a different phonology, and it actually encouraged me and impelled me to study African American vernacular English when I went away to university. So I got to study with Renee Blake out of Stanford University, who was then on faculty at NYU, whose major focus is copular forms of the verb to be, which was very interesting to me. Yeah. So I actually did a concentration in linguistics with a focus in African American vernacular English for my undergraduate degree. And so I've been told I sound white. I've been able to unpack that. I've been able to...
You studied it.
I studied
it. What does that mean, though?
I studied it for quite some time. So I don't think there's a such thing as sounding white.
Yeah.
When someone says that, I was like, do I sound white like a Scottish person? Do I sound like white like a Brahmin in New England? Do I sound white like someone from Utah? Where's my tongue in my mouth when I sound white? Are there interdental fricatives? You know, like I ask all of those things. And then at the same time, I do know what it means to switch. What Renee Blake called artfulness back in the day.
Artfulness
is a term that she coined, I believe, but it's about the level to which an R is pronounced or not in a word that often provides distinction
between
one sounding black or white. So I actually did mine. Our final for that course was to listen to a musician and just basically get I think 250 different examples of him using words that have R's in them, and then measure the amount of R that was in it. So we chose E40, who actually has more R-fulness than most people in African America. He tends to stress the R's
America.
Like America, you know, what would 40 waters.
Everybody got choices. I choose to get money, I'm stuck to this bread. Everybody got choices. These choosing them all in their heads. Everybody got choices.
You know, he would say his little bit more, whereas like a too short might lean back off the R a little bit.
That's interesting. I'm realizing my mom always says warder.
Warder, yeah.
I met this girl. Her name was Josh. She loved the way I rock on the microphone.
I'm trying to think of somebody who has like a definite East Coast sound and quote some art, like what would Biggie Smalls say?
It's all good, baby. It was all a dream.
What would Biggie say?
It was all a dream, and there's an R in there, but it's between two consonants, so that changes some of the rules. I can nerd out on you guys really hard, obviously, and I haven't studied in quite some time, but all of this I think affected my writing and affected the way I thought about what presenting blackness meant, what performing blackness meant, and what being blackness meant. And so I think all of that gets touched on when you ask if somebody sounds white. It's like, well, do I? And what does that mean? And I think it's always an affront when someone says you sound white, whether it's a black person or a white person who said it to me in the past.
And if you don't know, now
we were talking about, like, what do you think it would sound like if we actually weren't so aware of when we switch our voices back and forth? If we just spoke, like, if you turned on the news and you just heard someone say, what's up? Good evening. It's time to watch the news. Like, if you just heard that normal kind of family voice and the way that we talk around family, what do you think, like, it would, do you think it would sound different?
I think it might sound different. Lee. I don't know what it would be like. I feel like in some ways I wouldn't want that. I wouldn't. Part of the way that we speak to each other is our code, and we invented it for survival, and we need it from time to time. So I wouldn't, like, I don't know. I don't want them to know all our hair secrets and all our cooking secrets and all our
secrets,
vocal secrets.
Right?
We need some of them for ourselves, and
right.
I think that's part of the magic that keeps us young and vital and alive, you know? I think that having a language our own in a time where our children are being murdered, I think is an effective tool. So I like speaking lots of languages, but I don't know. I feel like folks need to be initiated into ours.
Have you ever been in a situation where you were asked to be to sound blacker?
Oh yeah,
like the other way.
Right. Yeah, I have been asked, and I have other friends who've been asked that. But then they don't, I mean, it typically unravels, you know, rather quickly with me. Because I just talk a lot of crap, so that usually opens a door much wider for whatever producer or college programmer brought me to their site. I'll begin this conversation immediately. Well, what do you mean? What do you want me to do?
Well, how do they say it?
Can you...
Tone it up?
Can you... Do you think you could just, There's always like a...
Do they dance like that when they
You
say
know,
it?
I won't say who, but it's actually less with folks like that. Because by the time someone brings me in to do poems at a school, they have a pretty good sense of who I am, and you know. But I did voiceover work for a while, and they give me notes like, we want to market to a more urban group. We want it to feel a little grittier or a little harsher. And so I started recording 3 takes of it, anything. So I'll say, like, Nabisco cookies are great to eat. That'd be the first take. The second take I would always do, and sort of like what it would be like if I were performing a poem. So I'd be like, Nabisco cookies are great to eat. A little more energy, a little more enthusiasm. And then they inevitably would pick the third one, where I would like do this before and be like, Nabisco cookies are great to eat. That would be the one that they picked. They always pick the third one. 100% of the time.
That did sound like the best one to me.
I mean, hey, it is what it is.
I like that one.
I mean, you're in my target demo, so.
This is The Stoop. I'm Hanat Baba.
And I'm Leela Day.
All right, so we're stooping today about feeling strange, weird, awkward as a Black person. Mm-hmm. And, like, we're thinking about, is there a, quote, right way and wrong way to, like, do Blackness? We're going to meet someone who's been thinking about that throughout his life. Someone who is very much in the public eye. Someone who performs for a living. Comedian and TV host W. Kamau Bell.
Kamau Bell.
I just had a matcha latte from the Arts Fancy coffee shop downstairs and part of a morning bun.
So Kamau's a comedian, he's an author, and he's the host of the CNN show United Shades of America. And Kamau has said that throughout his life he's felt awkward in a lot of Black communities that he's lived in.
Girl, his memoir is even called The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell.
There's always been a question of, like, I feel like I don't fit in. How do I fit in? And at some level it's like, don't try to fit in.
Kamau has been described as a blurred.
Blurred, Black nerd.
Black nerd.
When I was a kid, I just thought I was not cool.
And for Kamau, that blurredness started with the music he listened to.
I'm basically the same age as hip-hop, so I was, like, I remember hearing, like, the first hip-hop songs on the radio, like Rapper's Delight and Yes, I Can Do All the Words. But I didn't connect to it in a way that it was like, this is the best thing that ever happened to music. I didn't connect that deeply to it. So it was around me, but I knew I was supposed to connect to it. And I was often find myself in conversations with, you know, Black people. There'd be assumptions about my level of hip hop knowledge or the new album. And I would just have to either, you know, fake it, you know, or because I didn't want to be like, I don't really, you know, you always feel like, you know, until Carlton from The Fresh Prince, there was no way to sort of categorize that kind of Blackness. But it was just like you end up, that's like the thing, like, I don't really listen to the hip hop music, you know, so. So I was a kid who grew up into comic books and, you know, and reading a lot and, you know, and all these other, or, you know, sort of into things that, and also I think there's a part of it that, like, as a person whose references are, like, not the traditional black references, so, you know, I'm going to reference Cornel West and Jimi Hendrix and John Coltrane, you know, like, that somehow that means you're outside of mainstream culture, so therefore you're white people sort of claim this nerd status, and then this term blurred got created. And I was like, great.
And he says he really doesn't mind being called a blurred.
I'm glad to finally have a label, you know.
So you like it?
I mean, I think it's, I don't walk around calling myself a blurred, but I'm fine when people do it because I feel like it gives them people need a context for things. I don't hate it. I think it's funny. I'm glad that there is a label that is not pejorative for black people who are not into the things that black people are supposed to be into.
Okay, here we go again. Supposed to, right? Yeah. What's that about? And who says what the litmus test is for blackness or black culture?
I know. And for Kamau, he was like, and what is mainstream black culture anyway?
I found out later that what I thought was black culture was just a type of black culture. But America does a really good job of sort of boxing things up. And I think that even black people were sold on what black culture was. So at the time, I thought hip hop was the kind of music that all black people listened to, and maybe older black people listened to the blues. You know, we went to church with this and the gospel. And, you know, jazz is somewhere out there.
I mean, yeah, those are definitely some genres you think about when you think about black music.
There you go again.
What?
Making that box for what black people should be listening to, when, you know?
Right. I mean, I hear that. I mean, like me, I grew up listening to some hip hop and R&B, but also I loved me some Hall & Oates, some Gloria Estefan, you know?
Yeah.
Country music was played a lot in our house because my mom loved Kenny Rogers.
Oh, you are such a country Sudanese.
We're country Sudanese. She said it reminded her of Sudanese music, so, like, lots of country music.
And so, okay. But
like, am I less black because of that? Are we less black because of that?
You look very black to me. But let's go back to Kamau. So in high school, there was this revelation for him, right? And it blew his blurdy little mind. Now he was really into rock music.
So my two good friends listened to music, and at one time, one of them was talking about Jimi Hendrix, and I was like, Jimi Hendrix? And he's the greatest guitar player of all time. And I don't know how it came up, but one of them must have said something about him being black. And I'm like, Jimi Hendrix was black? How could the greatest rock and roll guitar player of all time be a black guy? Because I didn't connect that to blackness, you know, which is ridiculous when you think about it. Because, I mean, we're talking about the 80s. Like, you know, he died in the early 70s. So it's not, we're not talking about 100 years before. But in that time frame, Jimi Hendrix had been disconnected from his blackness enough that a black person could not know that he was black.
So then what was school like for little Kamau? Did he have any black friends?
Well, he moved around a lot with his family, and he ended up at a private school where he happened to test into these classes that were mostly white, with white kids. They're called Track 1 classes.
Track 1, those are like the high achievers, right?
Yeah, like the quote-unquote gifted class or whatever. Those were his friends. But then the black kids from the other classes did not like that.
I was standing with a group of my white friends, and a bunch of black kids sort of came at me and sort of pinned me up against the locker and sort of shook me down. And I was like, what's happening? And, you know, grabbed me and shook me around and sort of like, and then sort of dropped me and laughed and walked away. And one of these other black kids who was in one of the Track 1 classes was like, they did that because you don't hang out with the black kids. And I was like, I'm just hanging out with who's in my class. I hadn't put that level of thought on it. I was just, the kids I see in all my classes, I hang out with because I see them all the time, and that I wasn't breaking into, like, I'm only going to hang out with the white kids. I really didn't see it that way. Now I see how naive I was to not see it that way, even though I was a freshman in high school.
So Kamau grows up, and then he goes into comedy and finds, yet again, he feels like he doesn't belong.
I also started around the time that Def Comedy Jam started. there was a style of comedy that became really prevalent that was really infused by, like, Def Jam's a hip-hop label, so it was infused by hip-hop. And again, I wasn't listening to hip-hop. So even how I talk on stage, and because of where I've gone to school and my cultural references, again, are not those references. So anytime I would go to those clubs, when I started, like, black comedy clubs, I would feel like an outsider, and I would be like, there's no way that I could perform here. I'm not talking the way these people would want their comedians to talk.
Comedians like Sinbad or Jamie Foxx, Martin Lawrence.
What's up? What's up? Make some noise.
And yes. Luckily, I learned early on, and when I started really digging into comedy, because I'm a student of comedy, like, not all black comedians are like that, but then the choice becomes for a lot of black comedians, and you play the white rooms, and then a lot of times in the white rooms, the black comedians get relegated to sort of a, what I would call like a, I'm not like the others. My last special was called Private School Negro, sort of making fun of that idea. Like, a lot of those black comedians would be on stage like, when black people get loud, I don't know what to do. I went to private school. You know, like, I'm not quoting anybody's joke, but it's just the idea that, like, your character in front of a white audience becomes, I don't understand black people either. You know what I mean? And I was like, I can't do that. I can't.
So, Hannah, he wasn't really fitting in with the black comedy scene on one hand, mm-hmm. but then this idea of performing for the white crowd and having to play this role that wasn't really him, that was exhausting for him.
Yeah. And on top of all that, there was another thing, this thing that Chris Rock once told him.
When I got my first show, Totally Biased, Chris Rock was like, you're basically one of the spokespersons for black people right now because you're a black man on TV. So, like, whether you want to be or not, you are now one of the people they will come to when something black happens. The media will come to. You're also a person that black people are going to watch closely and go, is he, because at that point, he's like, you're not famous, I don't know who you are, so is he okay? Is he on our side? And so he's like, and I was like, but I don't want to do that. And he was like, you don't really have a choice.
But does that feel like a burden?
Yeah, it is a burden, and it's a burden that is just, that is baked into the cake of this life in America.
He's right, though. I mean, we feel this as black journalists and podcasters, that there's always this thought about, will black people come after us after this episode?
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this. Will this make someone mad? Will I get the blacklash?
And Kamau goes really deep with, like, the topics he discusses, especially with his show, United Shades of America. And in fact, he gets the blacklash a lot from this one episode where he goes to the Ku Klux Klan and he talks to a Klansman who has his voice disguised.
I'm proud of my race. I'm proud to be white. You proud to be a black man?
I am proud to be a black man.
Okay, let's hear it. You're a black man. You married a black woman?
I'm married to a white woman.
You know what the Bible says about racial marriage? An abomination of sin.
On the list of sins, where's interracial marriage? There's like murder. And is interracial marriage equal to that, or is it?
It'll be above because it's an abomination.
So it's worse than murder.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Every time the episode of United Shades re-airs where I talk to the Klan, there's a certain percentage of black people who will get on Twitter and be like, how could you do that? How could you put the Klan on TV? Also, how come you just stood there and listened to them talk and didn't fight with them or argue with them or say anything or hit them with a chair, and how you were basically letting down the race by doing that episode? So, and that happens whenever it just re-aired a couple weeks ago when the new season started. And I was like, as soon as I saw it, like the first couple seconds, I was like, ah, damn. Like, I was like, all right, let me go on Twitter and just sort of like put out these fires, you know.
And Kamau says the blacklash doesn't stop with that, but he's learned how to deal with it now in a way that doesn't distract him anymore. Like, I'm grown and I own it.
See, I'm so own the things that I am that I also, the things that I know that there might be black people who are upset about, like, you're not going to discover that I'm married to a white woman. It's very clear, and it's in, and I talk about it enough that it's not going to be something that you feel like I held from you. You're not going to discover that I went to a private school, and even though I'm claiming to be down with Black Lives Matter, my special's name, Private School Negro. So the things that I maybe would have been afraid of when I was younger, now I've learned to embrace them. But yeah, like, there's times when people still will be, you know, I'll run across some segment of black people who are like, how's he married to a white woman? But it's just like, if the things you're coming at me for are things that I feel good about and I'm proud of and are working well for my life, then it doesn't hold as much ammunition. I feel like a lot of this is a grown adult speaking. This is not the way I would have talked about this 10 or 15 years ago.
And we can both relate to this, Hannah,
mm-hmm.
right? Because as time goes on, we just start growing up and growing out of these anxieties a little bit,
yeah,
we start to care less, but it still burns.
It still hurts. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that age for me is called your 40s. But anyway, and for Kamau, what also helped was he found himself some other blurs on his network.
This is CNN Tonight. I'm Don Lemon. Are there things in your past that you would like to undo or that you regret?
100%. But you can atone for those things. You can make up for those things. You can try. You can at least try.
You can find redemption.
You can find redemption.
You can find redemption.
There could be a project that finds redemption for you.
There could be a redemption type project. Yes.
Hosted by Van Jones this Sunday at 9 p.m. on
okay.
CNN.
Thank you, sir.
So that's Kamau with Van Jones and Don Lemon from CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just three brothers hanging out on Don Lemon's show.
Yeah, that night was pretty magical. I remember seeing that on TV and just running to Twitter because, you know, I knew it was going to be good. And sure enough, Black Twitter was on fire. There was this one lady that was saying, I was flipping through channels and stumbled across Black CNN.
Don growing up Black and gay in the South. Van is, I didn't know him then, but is a militant out of Oakland. And me as this Black kid who was just staying up to watch Seinfeld on the Tonight Show with his Bruce Lee posters on the wall. It was clear we were all sort of like, we were allowed to be our full selves, which a lot of times when I grew up, there was, I don't believe this is the case anymore, but there's real anti-intellectualism surrounded by, like, if you got good grades, you were not cool. And so for me, the idea that we could all be up there and say all the smart things we wanted to say and still Black Twitter was like, yay, not like, who are these black cornballs up here? You know, it's just like it felt good to just sort of, I could relax. And I get to be myself because all of us are representing blackness on some level, but all of us are doing it in different ways. But I don't feel as much pressure to uphold the whole thing. I could relax and just be the funny guy.
So being authentically black, that burden, you know, it feels like people who are performers feel it more. You're in the spotlight, and so you're critiqued, like, harder.
Yeah, and remember what Kamau was talking about earlier, being asked to perform blackness? He wasn't comfortable with that. Yeah. And in a lot of spaces, that sometimes feels like what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel comfortable when people are like, hey. Or, a lot of, you know.
This is Beatrice Thomas, a.k.a. Black Benatar. And she's a female drag queen in the Bay Area. She's a performer. She reads books in drag at the Children's Library.
Go, Beatrice!
She's all in it. And so one thing that we know is that drag culture and black culture, they're very intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
So then what does it feel like to be in these spaces as a black queer queen?
You can communicate whole soliloquies with just a like, I appreciate that, but then you run into that white gay male who thinks that this is authentically theirs as a gay man, and it's, that stings. I mean, it stings because it is another form of erasure and invisibility. Queers are every age, every race, every gender. We are a microcosm of the world. And so there needs to be, at least for me, some acknowledgement that a lot of those things are being brought into what is our culture. I don't love seeing white gay men in cornrows, like a cornrow wig, or like, I don't love that. That stuff doesn't feel like an homage. Like, I'm like, I don't know if you were, you might just be making fun of like black people and not celebrating black culture.
And you've called someone out before?
No. Why? Because it's just like not my job. It's hard enough, honestly, being a woman in the drag scene. People will lay their hands on a drag queen. When I step into my body, my drag body and my drag makeup and all the everything, you know, I'm also bracing myself to be touched without consent very frequently.
What do you mean?
honk your boobs, slap your ass, grab you, squeeze you, touch you, you know?
Huh. And so do you think it's because you're a woman?
I think it's because I'm a queen. I think it's because I am of the performance of woman, because I am like taking it to the extreme. I think it happens to men. I think it happens to women. I think for me, the empowerment of doing drag is not about the power I wield in, like, in the club or the attention that I get.
When people touch you, do you look at that as part of the performance?
Yes. Like, at the end of the night, like, I'm exhausted for a very different reason than some of my other queen friends from the male axiology in terms of black culture and how it shows up in drag culture. I feel entitled to drag. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I am performing black womanhood. And, like, I'm performing the black womanhood that, like, of my aunties and my, like, southern cousins.
Yeah, when you say that you kind of, you know, you up the blackness around more, like, queer men, is that problematic?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. It is, like, I don't feel bad about it. It doesn't make me feel uncomfortable because I don't think I'm doing it in, like, a way that's really... I think it's funny that, like, I am basically the same person in, I mean, maybe times 11, but I'm basically the same person. But when I am in, I'm, like, wearing black Benatar, if I go, like, the feeling that people have when she does it versus when I do it, it's dramatically different. And that is something, you know, you use that to your benefit in the club.
And are there any black people in the audience when you're performing?
Sure. As many as there are statistically left in San Francisco.
What do you feel about performing blackness to a white audience?
I feel like I'm the best person for the job because I am very generous and I'm willing to share with them how not to be offensive. And that feels like a public service. I mean, that's the premise of my show.
On the stage, Black Benatar.
How are you feeling?
I feel like I said too much. Did I say anything embarrassing?
What would be embarrassing?
Why am I whispering into a microphone?
I like this part. What do you think might be embarrassing?
What if black people hate me after the interview?
Why do you think black people will hate you after the interview?
Because I'm different.
Oh my goodness. They're gonna love you even more.
I hope so.
Black Benatar, imagine being a black queer queen performing in front of mostly white audiences. In a space where you want to accentuate your blackness because that is who you are, but then feeling conflicted about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
Like, am I playing it up too much? What will people think?
Yeah, what will black people think? And right. I feel people don't think about the weight of this experience when you choose to do these things to kind of bring yourself out, mm-hmm. but yet you're still having this inner conflict about, am I disappointing someone?
Mm-hmm.
Am I black enough?
It's at the back of your mind.
Yeah. Am I doing the right thing? And I just want to say, I think she's doing the right thing.
I think she's doing the right thing. Kamau's doing the right thing. And we're doing the right thing, Lila.
Arr.
We're black enough for us.
Enough of the black lash.
And that's The Stoop. The Stoop is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX.
the Stoop family includes sound designers James Rollins, Seth Samuel, and Chris Hoff.
Editors are Julie Kane and Casey Miner. Music is by Daoud Anthony and Mazen Jamal. Episode art is by Nima Iyer.
Support for The Stoop comes from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org. And special thanks to the NPR Story Lab. Bye.
Take your favorite non-commercial radio station with you wherever you go with the WHFR radio app, now available for free in the Google Play Store. After installing the app, you can listen to WHFR live to your Android device anywhere in the world. There are also articles posted by WHFR staff and the latest updates to the WHFR schedule. WHFR To Go, free delivery, now available on the WHFR app and the Google Play Store.
The Black Male and Queens Focus Group is an academic and social support network at Henry Ford College. Our mission is to challenge and change the accepted narrative regarding Black academic success. The Focus Group provides a safe, nurturing, and supportive environment. We help students navigate HFC and connect them with campus resources. Our community-based approach assists students in building relationships with their peers. The Focus Group exposes students to opportunities within and outside the college to promote their academic and professional development. The Black Male and Queens Focus Group is open to all HFC students. For more information, visit our website at hfcc.edu/BMQFG. Again, that website is hfcc.edu/BMQFG.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.